You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, February 15th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Julia Rock, staff reporter at The Lever, on both the train derailment and the attempt by the National Association of Restaurants to derail the unionization movement in this country. Then Suzanne Nossel, CEO of Pan America, on the authoritarian censorship that is taking place in Florida. Also on the program today, the DOJ wants Trump's attorney's testimony, citing a fraud exception to the attorney privilege, a client privilege doctrine. Meanwhile, Dianne Feinstein to retire at the end of the term, assuming she can remember. Republican senators tell House Republicans no cut to defense spending. They're running out of things to put on the table. In the wake of Palestine, Ohio derailment, a commercial truck rolls in Arizona, spilling nitric acid. Meanwhile, Idaho House passes a ban on gender-affirming care. An Oklahoma judge strips a lesbian mom's parental rights because she's a lesbian.
Gave it to the sperm donor.
Yep.
Unreal.
U.S. signals to Ukraine to begin the end game. Republicans have a sad as the Republican on the FTC announces she's going to quit over the FTC doing its job. And a new study show a drastic emission cut is needed to avert massive sea level rises over the next couple of centuries. And lastly, Elon Musk finally turns Twitter into his own personal Twitter. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. This is the day that we, we have a lot invested in this day. We've monetized our co-host's phrase that she coined, and it's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not seeing that many royalties from it, but...
Well, these things take time. But yeah. Why don't you go ahead, do your catchphrase.
I don't know. Open your books. Show me how much you actually are making, because I don't know if my contract has any stipulations that I'm getting enough of that.
As you know, work for hire, when you coin a phrase, like your phrase, we, the Majority Report Empire... monetizes it.
Mm. Consult your NDA, Emma.
I mean, wow. I thought you were
unless you want to be broke
NDA.
For life.
Dance, monkey, dance.
To a financial
it's hump day.
And it's hump day. That's right. It's hump day, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
Thanks for joining us on this hump day. Don't forget, every time you use that, we make some figure that, and by we, I mean, of course, me. My coffers just begin to... ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned this earlier. Well, first off, Dianne Feinstein to retire. I don't want to be glib about it. I certainly, I have firsthand experience with people her age who are suffering from some form of dementia, but her office announced that she was going to retire. And then moments later, she was asked about it. And she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then she was reminded that her office said she was going to retire. And she goes, oh, well, it looks like I'm going to retire.
Yeah.
And my concern is there's another 2 years or a year and a half. Another 2 years before she's slated to retire. I guess 1 year and 11 months. And it's just stunning that there does not seem to be any mechanism within the Democratic Party, at least. I mean, I'm sure they have this problem, the Republican Party, to some extent as well, to say, hey, you know, we really need a senator who is, you know, this isn't a question of health. It is about, mental acuity. That's what it is. And hopefully she will make it to retirement. And then also hopefully at this point, I'd like Katie Porter to win. But let's talk about what's happening in Washington. We're still months away from when the final debt ceiling drop dead day will be. And at the State of the Union, in addition to basically getting a pledge from the Republicans that they weren't going to touch Social Security and Medicare, Biden also said, bring me your plan, and then we can talk about plans to, you know, ostensibly make cuts in the budget. And they're running out of things to cut.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you know, they claim that Social Security and Medicare are off the table. Which it appears that it is, at least for the time being. And now it's being reported that the Republican senators in the Senate are saying to Republican members in the House, don't cut defense, even your so-called woke cuts to defense. And frankly,
yeah,
I'd like
just
to
cut the trillions of woke stuff.
Yeah, I personally, I am very much down with the cutting of defense. I don't think that there's going to be that much woke stuff that they find.
Yeah.
So if they've got to
look
do
hard.
Some of the non-woke stuff, I'm okay with that. That would be a good thing. But the bottom line is there's increasingly less and less that the Republicans can come to the table with and pretend that they want cut. Here is Rick Scott still basically saying, I am not for cutting Social Security and Medicare, except for I think we should put it in a position to be cut. And why? Because, I don't know.
This is a bold stance to take as the senator from Florida, where there are a lot of retirees.
Well, he is vying for a bigger job, I think.
Congress ought to tell you how they're going to preserve Medicare and Social Security that are going bankrupt. Now, they say, oh, if I put it, I said in there, we ought to review programs every 5 years. He said, somehow that's a cut. Well, you know what? What do we do on defense? Well, there's no 40-year plan for defense. There's no 100-year plan for defense. Every year we go through the defense budget. So if you don't support a 100-year defense plan, you must be cutting defense every year. So this is disingenuous. I don't believe that we should ever be reducing Medicare or Social Security benefits. But guess what? $31.5 trillion worth of debt. When we get to $45 trillion of debt, is somebody going to take this stuff seriously? Say, how do we preserve these programs?
You know, I mean,
what are we supposed to take? What is guess what supposed to be? I don't want to cut Social Security and Medicare, but guess what?
Yeah.
We'll be forced to.
We're going to have to.
And the big elephant in the room is that you could just maintain all of these programs with ease if you were to raise taxes, but that's not anything that he would consider.
No. And neither the rest of the Republican caucus. They will not raise taxes. And the idea that you need to reauthorize this every 5 years, again, by doing nothing, it could go away. And then they'd say, I didn't vote against it. I just didn't vote for it. We just didn't bring it up for a vote. Here is Mitch McConnell, however, who is in a battle with Rick Scott. You will notice he is not standing behind Mitch McConnell here. And McConnell is arguing we're not going to do anything on Social Security and Medicare, which is true because they won't raise taxes.
We've been talking a lot about Rick Scott's plan. Now it's not the Republican plan. At this point, would you like to see him disavow the plan, or how do you move forward as a party with the White House using this against him?
Well, one more time, let's talk about Social Security. As you recall, there was some confusion last year about what the agenda of the Republican Senate might be if we were in the majority. And I made it quite clear that as the likely majority leader, I had hoped at that time, Social Security and Medicare were not on our agenda, period. As you recall, this continues to come up. The president was talking about it in the State of the Union. He's taken it out to various states around the Union. So let me say one more time. There is no agenda on the part of Senate Republicans to revisit Medicare or Social Security, period. I've noticed that the Speaker of the House has said the same thing. So on Social Security, it is not an issue between the parties.
I mean, this is...
I love it.
It's a big deal. And, of course, McConnell's really only saying, like, right now we realize that we're not on great footing to go after Social Security and Medicare. Like, we've lost this political battle. And because we had a ding-dong out there who basically, you know, showed too much, essentially.
Same thing happened before the election with Lindsey Graham and abortion. I was saying this before the show. This is a unique moment for Mitch McConnell. His caucus is not as in order as we've been accustomed to, I would say.
It's hard to understand, like, what Rick Scott's agenda is unless... You think back to this guy was the CEO of a company that provided a lot of Medicaid services, and I presume Medicare services.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he still has an interest in that particular company, but you know what happens when you cut Medicare is that someone's going to be paying the money.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not going to be the government. And it means that the government doesn't have the ability to depress medical expenses at all. Medicare is a depressant on these on the costs of medicine. Now, it's not enough because it only provides health insurance for a quarter of the country, maybe 15% of the country. But that's the plan. And so, you know, a small cut in Medicare is going to raise the value of your health care interests if you are that guy.
It is a bold stance for him to take, especially if you look up Rick Scott's history with Medicare and Social Security fraud. It's just, I mean, the fact that he's decided...
51 times, was it, he took the fifth?
Yeah.
Was it 51 times? He took the fifth a lot on that, for whatever reason.
So he would know about Medicare and Social Security waste. Fraud.
I would imagine.
75 times.
Well, 75. That's only 25 times more.
Nice round number.
Yeah. We got a couple of words from our sponsors today, and then we'll be talking to Julia Rock, staff reporter at the Lever. As you know, I am a slightly uptight about having my identity stolen online. I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm not proud of that. But I am proud of what I've done about it, and I've done it with the help of Aura. Aura is an easy-to-use app. It includes everything you need to stay safe online. It protects you from scammers and hackers and phishers by scanning the so-called dark web, and it looks to see if your passwords, your emails, your Social Security numbers are being traded between hackers and scammers and thieves, essentially. And if it finds anything, it alerts you fast. When you sign up for the free trial that you get with our link at aura.com/majority, you put your email in and it'll tell you where your email and passwords have been compromised around the web on different websites. They also help you fight back against those websites that make all of your information public. They send automatic pull down orders, essentially, of your information. And that helps you reduce robocalls. It helps you reduce junk mail. It also protects your public information, or gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries. So if your daughter, let's say, for instance, is thinks she's a mogul in selling the clothes that you have bought her and now needs a bank account, which is good. At least she's saving the money or attempting to. And you go set up a bank account in her name. If you're like me, you'll get a little ping saying, we just want to make sure this was you and you knew about this. And I did. And so I felt pretty good about the fact they were on it. They have a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. They protect your devices from viruses and malware, all that kind of junk, spyware. They also help you manage what your kids can do on their devices. So you can restrict the specific apps. You can set screen time limits. You can set focus time so that they're not, you know, watching YouTube instead of doing homework. They got a password manager that lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. And the bottom line is you may have one or two apps that do one or two of these things, but you don't need seven apps. You can use Aura. You're going to be shocked at how much private information Aura finds exposed. Over the 2 weeks that Aura is now giving you a free trial with my link, aura.com, aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority to start your free trial. There will be, of course, a link in the YouTube and podcast descriptions. Also, today's program sponsored by ZBiotics. I took some of this over the weekend.
Did it help?
Oh, yeah. I went down to Jersey for a like a buddy's old birthday party, and I was like, I know I'm going to be drinking, but I know I got to get up early and come back up to get the kids and ZBiotic, and I a little bit overindulged, I have to say, but I felt great the next day. And why is that? ZBiotic is a pre-alcohol probiotic. It is genetically engineered. You drink it before drinking alcohol. And you avoid a rough next morning. That's it. Simple, easy, straightforward. It was invented because they know that the real problem with drinking and feeling bad the next day is not dehydration. That happens. It's good for you to stay hydrated. But it's a toxic byproduct of alcohol. And ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic is the only product that breaks that down. You just got to remember, you drink responsibly. You get plenty of rest, too. You drink a tiny little thing this size before you start drinking, and it takes care of you. It doesn't matter if you want tomorrow to be, you know, a productive one or a relaxing one or, you know, one where you're working out, whatever it is. Combine, you know, ZBiotic with some healthy and responsible drinking habits. And again, when tomorrow rolls around, you're going to be ready to make the most of it. You can get 15% off your first order of ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic by clicking the link in the description box using my code MAJORITY at checkout. Go to ZBiotics.com/majority. Use the code MAJORITY at checkout. Get 15% off your first order. Link, of course, embedded in the YouTube and podcast and website descriptions. And lastly, you know, in the past, I've used some of these services that send you food, right? And you make a meal,
mm-hmm.
And they've been good. So, you know, some better than others, but the biggest problem I had was they weren't so easy to make. If I had an extra 45 minutes, 50 minutes, then maybe it worked out. And I found one now, HelloFresh, where you're getting, it's great ingredients, very fresh, obviously.
HelloFresh. It's so crazy. I was literally just looking into HelloFresh two days ago.
Okay. So these things took about 15 minutes each to prep. And the cooking time was not out of, out of bounds either. The whole thing, I get it. From the moment I get home, open it up, they organize it better. into its own separate paper bags. It was really easy. Myla cooked one of these meals. We had, what was the first one? There was one with the big pasta and sausage. It was delicious. And then I made some bulgogi, like sauce meatballs on rice. That was great. What was the one that Myla made? It was really good. I was really impressed, and it's easy. Doesn't matter what your lifestyle and meal preferences are, too, about HelloFresh. They have recipes to please everyone at your table. They got fit and wholesome. They got veggie. They got family-friendly. All sorts of, like, you can get three meals. You can get you can switch from two to four meals of the same meal or people, I should say. They have 40 weekly recipes at HelloFresh on a weekly basis that you can choose from. You're only going to find quality ingredients in their recipes. In fact, HelloFresh ingredients travel from the farm to your home in less than 7 days, so you know they're fresh. I really enjoyed it. It's super fast. It's easy. And like I say, my daughter, who is, you know, I mean, she's competent, but she's not a cook. She did it, and I did it. Saul loved the food. I love the food. Go to HelloFresh.com/majority65. That's the number 65. And use the code majority65 for 65% off plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/majority65. Use the code majority65. You will get 65% off plus free shipping. Check that out. We have a link in the podcast and YouTube description. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Julia Rock, staff reporter at The Lever. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program Julia Rock. She's a staff reporter at The Lever or Lever. That's the first question I'm going to ask you, Julia. And I'll say, we had originally booked you to talk about a great piece that you wrote on visiting one of those National Restaurant Association meetings where they're talking about how they're going to go about union busting, essentially. And in the meantime, you've written a couple of pieces about the rail companies in the wake of this rail spill, essentially, in Palestine, Ohio. So let's start with that. I should also say that's one of the things I really like about the Lever. You guys do some great reporting. First question, Lever or Lever?
I say Lever, but I'm going to say on this show, Lever. I like how it sounds. It's a little bit more elegant. I'm going to stick to Lever. Yeah.
All right, fantastic. So let's start with this. You've written a couple of pieces along with Rebecca Burns and one with Sirota and Matthew Cunningham Cook about the what may very well be, and we don't know for sure at this point exactly what contributed to all the factors in this accident in Ohio, but why don't you let us know what we do know is clearly, you know, has been clearly identified as at least a cause. And then from there, we can go backwards on the rollback of safety regulations that essentially may have allowed this and the failure of this administration to reimpose them.
Yeah. So cause of the derailment, as it's currently sort of being reported and understood by regulators, was a broken mechanical axle that was apparently on fire for at least 20 miles before the train derailed. So the train did an emergency stop, and that sort of led to the derailment. The backstory, as you allude to, is a much longer story, which has to do both with sort of what rail workers are now referring to as the buyback era in the railroads, which is the era of the 2010s when railroad companies spent far more on stock buybacks than, you know, investments in infrastructure on the railroads. They slashed their workforces by nearly 30% in an attempt to beef up profits. Now inspection times are falling, or inspections aren't happening altogether on the trains. So it sort of created a perfect storm in some sense for what just happened in East Palestine. There's another really important element that the Lever has been covering, which is that also during this buyback era, the railroad industry was lobbying against all sorts of safety regulations that would have required things like speed limits on trains carrying flammable chemicals, better braking systems, better safety retrofits on tanks. So it's like, this is the entire backdrop. They're spending their money, returning profits to shareholders. They're slashing their workforces. Their workers are exhausted, and they've fought and very successfully, in many cases, killed regulations that would have made these trains safer.
I mean, so this is, again, a classic case of privatizing the profits that are made by socializing the risks associated with what they're doing, and you said lever, but that's all right. So I mean, let's specifically talk about that. So there's really two sort of almost like silos of things that led to this in terms of, I mean, there's a lot of different factors, obviously, but what could have been done differently? We don't know why that axle was on fire, but we do know that there are plenty of times where these trains have to stop. And if they're fighting regulations about the speed in which these things travel, that stopping becomes more perilous. Let's talk about the brakes, because this seems to be like sort of the most obvious example of this, and how this company in particular went from sort of touting these brakes as a potential revolutionary or safety feature to forget about that.
So I do a lot of stories on corporate malfeasance and corporate capture of regulators, and this story still blew my mind. Basically, right now, freight trains in the U.S. have braking systems that were designed in 1868. And essentially, they stop trains car by car, one at a time. And trains are getting very long. The one that derailed in East Palestine had 150 cars. I think it was nearly 10,000 feet long.
So and we should just why are they that long now? Because this is also part of the story. Like, each one of these elements are part of the story of them trying to just maximize their profits at the sake of safety.
Yeah, so my understanding is it's sort of like an efficiency thing, and you can have fewer workers if you make the trains longer and longer. So this is part of the slashing of the workforce. So rewind to 2007, and Norfolk Southern, whose train just derailed in East Palestine, starts touting this new braking system, which is far better. They say it can reduce stopping distances on trains by up to 60%. And rather than stopping trains car by car, as the old system does, it can stop all the cars at once, which is a pretty good idea. So they're touting the benefits of this new braking system, an ECP braking system. It's electronically controlled pneumatic brakes, and saying how great it is and how, you know, it will be good for the train companies because they won't need to inspect the brakes as often. After stopping a train, you can get it going again more quickly, etc. In the 2010s, as more and more crude oil is being shipped on trains, as well as other hazardous materials, the Obama administration says, well, great, you know, you've discovered and designed this new braking system that will make trains quite a bit safer, prevent derailments. we're going to move to require them on trains carrying highly hazardous flammable materials. So they move to issue a regulation. The industry turns against it. They fight tooth and nail, including Norfolk Southern. They reported lobbying against it. The Obama administration issues a rule. It only applies to sort of a narrow class of trains, but they do the ECP braking rule. And then the rail industry continues to fight it. They get it repealed under Trump.
Why were they touting it at one point and then saying, actually, no, we don't really want it? What was the theory behind that? Is that just to drive their stock prices up?
Yeah, I've heard two explanations for it. So one is that, you know, even though the companies knew it would lead to cost savings in the long term, there's sort of this idea that Wall Street is not okay with any type of substantial capital expenditure. So this is part of the buyback era story. They don't care about long-term cost savings. They don't want money spent in the short term. Something that a couple of former Federal Railroad Administration regulators told me that you hear in all sorts of, fights over regulations is that even though the train companies know the brakes are better, they don't want to give regulators a foot in the door. They see any regulation as like encroachment on their industry. They'll just fight any regulation, even if it's good for their bottom line. So those were the two explanations that I really found to be the most compelling in my reporting.
Because
that makes you can expand on it. I just wanted to move to the fact that the Biden administration hasn't reinstated it. I mean, the fact that it doesn't even really harm the industry profit-wise to that much, it's just the principle of the thing, I think underscores how inexcusable it is that Buttigieg and the Biden administration haven't been proactive on this and don't seem to have any plans to reinstate these regulations.
Well, let's go into that, because I mean, it's the industry, it seems to me, and this is something that I think there, we can see across the board with all industries. They don't want the precedent set. Even if it saves them money, they don't want the precedent set that there is authority for the federal government to impose safety restrictions on them or worker rule or anything. The precedent is bad, and they will. And I would also argue that as far as the timing, and I haven't quite dug into this quite enough, but the timing seems to be that they are on a move to cut their workforce. And so they need to justify their ability to cut their workforce. And there's sort of almost like a bait and switch here. We've developed these new braking system that's going to allow us to cut our workforce, expand the length of the trains. And this gets into the whole union thing where they wouldn't let them have, sick days because they have a very lean workforce. And these breaks are going to allow us to, cut our workforce. And then they realize, like, at one point, like, we can just cut our workforce and we don't actually have to institute those, technological advances that would have maintained some measure of safety. But talk about, like, how much of an expectation was there that after the Trump administration rolled back these sort of very narrow requirements for these breaks in specific really hazardous situations? What was the expectation in terms of what the Biden administration would do?
Yeah, so at the time of the Trump repeal, there was pretty widespread outcry from environmental groups, Democrats. I think Senator Merkley said, redo the cost-benefit analysis and reinstate the rule. There was a finding that the Trump cost-benefit analysis had been faulty. They didn't really factor in the cost of derailments, which somewhat makes sense because often rail companies don't pay that cost anyways. but there were sort of widespread calls at the time for the rule to be reinstated. When Biden came into office, some of the unions were pressing Biden and as you say, Buttigieg, who's at the helm of the Transportation Department, to redo the ECP brake rules. And there was actually a congressional hearing last summer on rail safety where a former FRA regulator said, like, redo the brake rule. There are going to be more derailments. This is a high stakes situation. So there have been calls for the rule to be redone. Now, in the past few days, some lawmakers like Representative Ilhan Omar have called for the rules to be reinstated. We're learning a lot about the Buttigieg Transportation Department, I guess, in recent months. So Expectations are extremely low, but there are calls for him to redo this rule.
Do we know where these ideas, I mean, like, it seems like these railroads did a broad sort of like efficiency measures they started to institute, 15 years ago or so. What consulting company was brought in to help them with these logistics? Do you know? By any chance?
Was it McKinsey?
Well, I don't know.
That's why it sounds like them, right?
I mean, you know, it's not hard to imagine. And if it wasn't McKinsey, it was somebody who had a consulting firm that was just like McKinsey.
Right. I mean, the point you're making is correct, which is that this is the consulting firm playbook, is like destroy your company and juice the profits. So Pete Buttigieg certainly has experience in that type of business model from his time at McKinsey.
But I think that's the answer, right? I mean, we're kind of saying, why are they not re-implementing this rule? It's because he's ideologically, I think, much more sympathetic to what the railroads are trying to do with an efficiency model than the safety regulations that would be imposed. I mean, that it's ideological with him, I would say. Yeah, I mean, there's no question there. It's just
Julie, one last thing too. You mentioned they apply a cost benefit analysis. This is the transportation. Who does this? Like, I know EPA has a version of this as well. In fact, like the courts sort of force these agencies to apply it, or sometimes there are lawsuits. Just walk us through a little bit what it is in this instance, and then I want to talk about your union piece.
Yeah, so the cost-benefit analysis came out of an industry effort to slip a provision into a 2015 transportation bill saying the ECP brake rule would not go into effect if the benefits didn't outweigh the costs. And so the cost benefit analysis was done during the Trump administration. I believe it was sort of done in part by the National Academy of Sciences. I think the Government Accountability Office was involved, but the Transportation Department was sort of in charge of the whole thing.
And that analysis is always a function of what the inputs are, right? I mean, in other words, like, the cost-benefit analysis to me is very different than it is to the CEO of that company, right? I mean, the cost-benefit analysis for the people living in Palestine, Ohio, very different than it is for the shareholders of the freight company.
Oh, completely. A derailment costs, you know, residents of a town a lot more than it costs the company because we don't hold them very liable for the cleanup costs. And, you know, there was sort of an additional somewhat technical point, but the railroad industry was sort of complaining that the cost benefit analysis didn't have enough data to be done adequately, and then they wouldn't hand over the data required to do, you know, an effective cost benefit analysis. So they were like, look, you don't have enough data. And it was like, well, who has the data?
Yeah, it's a neat trick. All right. Well, let's turn and folks, we will link to at least two of the pieces that I know you've written about in all our descriptions. But let's talk about your piece, which I really enjoyed from I guess it was 2 weeks ago now. Fear and Loathing Among the Union Busters. It is, you went to, I assume you visited the National Restaurant Association's, legal conference, essentially what it was. Just start with I really enjoyed the National Labor Relations, lawyer, showing up there and sort of, maybe not meeting their expectations as they had in the past. Will you just walk us through that a little bit, and then let's just talk about the things you heard?
Well, yeah. So the National Restaurant Association is a massive lobbying group that's basically focused on keeping wages low for workers. And so I go to this conference sort of wondering why the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, Jennifer Abruzzo, who's been sort of a firebrand really on the side of workers, is speaking to this lobbying group. There, it's sort of a common thing for regulators to go talk to lobbying groups and you know, sort of cozy up, rub shoulders, you know, give them a sense of what's happening, say everything's going to be okay. But instead, you know, Abruzzo gives this very stern speech to the audience saying, if you fire workers for unionizing, I will get them reinstated. You know, other administrations may have sought 80% back pay. I'm going for 100% back pay. I know you're not required to post the National Labor Relations Act in your workplace, but you should really do it. And, you know, if there are violations in one of your restaurants, we're going to go look at the other restaurants, because usually that's a sign of a pattern. So she's saying all of these things that, you know, you don't really want to hear if you're a massive restaurant chain, and you probably don't expect to hear if you've paid to go to a lobbying group conference.
How effective, like, I mean, give us a sense of just sort of an assessment of how well staffed the National Labor Relations Board is versus where it's traditionally been, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And how, like, what was the reaction? I mean, I love that story, because that is exactly what they should be doing. And you never hear it go down that way. It's usually, like you say, they go and they cozy up, or they just avoid it. But going in there and basically saying, like, I don't necessarily have knowing that she doesn't necessarily have all the resources to fight all these people, but, like, also knowing that if I show up there and, you know, make a show of it that I'm going to fight you, that's done maybe 5 or 10% of the work that she would have to litigate.
No, absolutely. I mean, as you alluded to, the National Labor Relations Board budget was frozen for a bit over a decade. It was just increased a little bit in December. But this is a very understaffed agency. You know, they've been saying for years that they can't do their work properly. And obviously, it's intentionally understaffed. Corporations lobby the government not to fund it. And right, you know, she talked a lot about the idea that there's, like, a chilling effect when corporations fire workers for union organizing, even if she gets them reinstated. And she's sort of trying to figure out how to, fight back against that chilling effect. But as you sort of gesture to, there's a little bit of a chilling effect if she goes and says, you know, we're going to fight you if you fire these workers for union organizing.
And so give us a sense of, like, what were the other sort of main themes that you heard there? I mean, there was one piece, a moment in the piece, if I remember correctly, where the quote was something to the effect of, like, you know, we got a problem, because it was always like people don't want to pay for union dues. But it was almost like it was almost like Jerry Seinfeld complaining about, like, college audiences. And he's going, like, and the guy says, like, but these kids these days, they don't mind paying union dues. It's cheaper than Netflix or something, right? Doesn't it? Like, what will you just walk us through that quote?
Yeah. So that's a quote in the context of a lawyer from Jackson Lewis, probably the most notorious union busting law firm in America, explaining why some of the old union busting tactics, or the lines like the classic one the boss will give, you know, you don't want to pay union dues, do you? Aren't really working in this particular era of union busting, especially in the restaurant and hospitality industries. And it, you know, it gestures to a larger theme of the conference, which is that people, both lawyers and sort of the restaurant chains in attendance, really had this sense that what is happening at Starbucks right now, where very young workers have just very quickly organized a huge number of stores. Last I checked, it was 280 stores in like a year and a half. You know, that could happen to your restaurant chain too. And this is being done not, you know, by a union coming in and trying to organize. It's just being done by the young people who work in your stores. So there's a real sense at the conference that the people doing this organizing aren't institutionalized unions. They're just sort of workers in these stores, that they're very young, that they're very sort of amenable to social justice type messaging, that they're concerned about social justice issues, and that you can't say anything mean to them. They were at one point, this Jackson Lewis lawyer says that they sort of want everything light and fluffy.
Well, give us a sense of, like, one of the things that I remember in the piece too is they said that because they are so sensitive to these things, and because I imagine on some level it's because there are more and more resources available to young people who want to unionize, let's say, in their restaurant in terms of what is allowed and what's not, they said you should start having sort of mandatory meetings now with your employees before they start a unionization drive, so that when you want to deploy mandatory meetings to poison their minds against the union, it won't seem like you're doing something different. Right? Was that what one of their strategies? Will you walk through for folks, because we have folks who you know are calling all the time. They're trying to unionize their place. What is reiterate that strategy if you would, and what other strategies did you glean that they are trying to prep their restaurants for?
Yeah, so this is quite an interesting one, and part of the context is that Jennifer Abruzzo had talked about captive audience meetings during her speech, and she is trying to make those meetings illegal, where workers sort of have to go hear anti-union messaging from the boss. So the Jackson Lewis lawyer scheme to both get around Abruzzo and a workforce that might not like the idea of a captive audience meeting is, you know, before you hear about any union efforts, start meeting with your workers and telling them what a great company they work for. It sounds a lot like a captive audience meeting, but there's no mention of unions. And have this be a regular thing that you do. It'll make them feel more engaged in the workplace. It will make them less likely to unionize because they'll realize you're sort of a great company that cares about, you know, social justice as they do. And then if they do decide to file for a union election, you're already having meetings where you talk about what a great workplace this is, and you can sort of easily turn those into captive audience meetings without them really seeming as such. The underlying idea, obviously, is that your workers are too dumb to realize it's a captive audience meeting, which I would find very surprising. I think it's pretty obvious when the boss has pulled you into a meeting to give you anti-union messaging. But there you have it. Another tactic they discussed that was somewhat related is, you know, the Jackson Lewis lawyers were saying everybody's talking about ESG. This is environmental, social, corporate governance investing. And they sort of clearly saw ESG as this, somewhat false vessel for conveying the great social and environmental efforts at a company. And they were basically saying your investors can sort of be duped on the ESG stuff, so can your workers. So have them doing things like being on sustainability committees, being on community engagement committees, and so they can feel like they're sort of getting their fill of social justice. You can tell the investors you're doing it and that it makes you a great ESG company, and your workers will be less likely to unionize.
That reminds me, incidentally, about the staff meeting that we're going to have afterwards. But aside from that, last question. You mentioned, that Abruzzo's looking to, promulgate, regulation that would make captive audience meetings, out of bounds. What other things, and I think there was one other, that was mentioned, about the persuader rule, or some type of like transparency about persuaders. What other things could the Biden administration do? And I know that they've passed some things that have helped in organizing. But what other these small measures that are sort of like, you know, small bore, but these tactical things that really can make a difference in the ability of workers who are motivated to organize, make it easier for them to do so?
Yeah, so there are two things I'm certainly thinking about. One is the persuader rule, which you mentioned, which was initially done under the Obama administration. And so the background is that if you're working at a company, say you're working at McDonald's, you're trying to unionize. McDonald's learns you're trying to unionize, and they hire a firm where they're paying, you know, thousands of dollars an hour to union bust. They don't have to disclose that to you. The persuader rule required companies, when they retain a third party to help union bust, basically, they would have to disclose it. That's helpful for workers because then you can say to your coworkers, like, look, you think McDonald's isn't trying to union bust? They just hired the biggest union busting firm in America. Obviously, this is what they're doing. Additionally, unions are subject to really stringent transparency requirements. So there's quite an imbalance. Biden has not redone the persuader rule. So we don't know who's doing the union busting. That would be helpful to workers.
So to be another clear, thing I'm thinking, was that reversed during the Trump years?
Sorry. Yes. Everything good that remotely good that Obama did reversed during the Trump years. Many of it not reinstated under Biden. Persuader rule, a great example.
Okay. And I'm sorry, the second one.
Yeah. And another thing I'm thinking about is something that Biden, you know, promised to do on the campaign trail and has promised to do since then, which is, you know, not to give federal contracts to companies that do union busting. And this is, pretty standard for conditions to be attached to federal contracts. There's sort of broad authority under the Federal Procurement Act to attach standards to them. And some of these huge companies like Amazon that are, notorious for their union busting are hugely reliant on federal contracts for their businesses. I mean, Amazon Web Services, the cloud platform, is massively propped up by government contracts. So Biden has said he will not grant contracts. He had previously said that he would do some type of rule or order saying they wouldn't grant contracts to companies that were doing union busting. You could also do things like labor peace agreements, but use that federal procurement authority to help workers. They haven't done that.
All right. I guess lastly, Abruzzo sounds good. The National Labor Relations Board seems to have been to be effective to the extent that it can be. Where's the problem? Like, is there a problem at the Labor Department? Where is the, or is it just simply the Biden administration is against these things, or where is the logjam for measures like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something I'm thinking about because, you know, you have regulators like Jen Abruzzo, like Lena Khan doing really great work. And then you have regulators like Mayor Pete not doing any work.
Right.
And it's a little bit confusing that that's all happening in one administration. You know, I think with particular things like the persuader rule, I've written a lot about the lobbying efforts against it. The American Bar Association, weirdly, the Guild for Lawyers is really against it, and they have a lot of influence. You can imagine on the contracting stuff, Amazon has a lot of influence in the federal government. So I think with all of these things, you know, it's probably a story of a little bit more, capture of government, as well as, you know, Marty Walsh was not very ambitious in the Labor Department. So perhaps that shouldn't be too surprising to us either.
Julia Rock from The Lever or The Lever. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put links to all of your reporting there. Really great stuff. Really appreciate the work that you guys are doing over there.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks a bunch. And we have a couple more stories coming out on the rail stuff and Pete's authority. So keep an eye out.
Great. Thank you so much. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Suzanne Nossel. She is the CEO of Pan America, about what's going on in Florida. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the program Suzanne Nossel. She's the CEO of Pan America. Suzanne, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You guys have been doing a lot of work on what's going on in Florida. Just in off the top, we have at least three laws that have passed that essentially make it harder for teachers to teach things. and to have books. What just characterize what's going on in Florida in a broad way relative to what you have seen in this space, as it were.
Yeah, look, I mean, relative to what I've seen in this space, I have to say, you know, it remains pretty shocking to me what is happening here in our own country. We used to deal at Pan America with book bans. We'd have one or two a year, you know, a parent somewhere around the country would contact a librarian and ask that a book be taken off the shelf. We'd write a letter. Usually the book was put back. This is something categorically different. This is an assault on education, on the freedom to learn. It's ideologically driven. Look, I understand some of the roots of this, and I sympathize with the idea that some of the ways that we're instructing kids, you push the envelope further than parents and communities are comfortable with, that there are certain ideas and perspectives that feel off limits on particular campuses. It's hard to be a conservative on a college campus these days. And so that's legitimate. But to turn to legislation as the weapon of choice, which is what Governor DeSantis, the Florida legislature, has done, and to respond to informal censoriousness coming from the left with government-mandated edicts that prohibit certain ideas and books from being taught in classrooms, that ups the ante. And that, to me, is inimical to the First Amendment and our freedom of speech.
Where is that line? Because, I mean, I think, like, you know, a lot of these actions, and we'll go through, you know, what these laws actually do, and they sort of do two things, right? I mean, they do what is explicit, and then they have sort of this, almost this sort of like atmosphere around the law that functions as, you know, in chilling effect. And in some ways, that sort of like membrane around the law, because of its vagueness, has even a worse impact. But where is the line here? Like, where do we go from, you know, these college students with their political correctness is, you know, sort of is annoying and oppressive, you know, to me personally, because, you know, I can't express my ideas without criticism. And then where we cross the line into what is really sort of like genuinely, well, I don't want to say genuinely problematic, because although that's what I do feel, but is sort of like an abuse of authority. Like when we get in, when we say things like authoritarian, you know, like where is that line for you coming, you know, from this space that you've worked in for years?
Look, I think on all forms of infringement on freedom of speech sort of have that silencing effect, you know, whether it's speaking up in a classroom and saying something on transgender issues or on affirmative action or on reproductive rights that flouts the conventional wisdom. What we hear again and again from students is people fall silent. They're all looking at each other. No one will respond to you. And you feel ostracized and like you're an outcast. And you really think twice about bringing up that perspective next time. I think that's a serious problem because it's pervasive. And there is a kind of orthodoxy that has set in on a lot of campuses. But, you know, when you really want to talk about crossing over into authoritarianism, to me, that's when you invoke the power of the state. This is not, you know, a social matter where people have kind of come together and they've got an ideology and they're trying to enforce it and propound it among a student body. You know, I think that's problematic, but I think it's a category further. You're going to make a hierarchy of threats to free speech. I don't think there's any question that you have to put state-sponsored legislation, laws at the top of the pyramid, because that's got the force of law. The police can go after you. You might be fined. You might be penalized. If you're on the faculty, you could lose your job. A college could be shut down or taken over, as is happening at the New College of Florida. And so the consequences are really serious. That's not to say on the other side there isn't a problem, but you deal with that problem through dialogue, through ensuring that you have heterodox views on campus, that conservatives have a space to be heard and to organize. So there are other methods that don't involve this very heavy hand of the state.
And again, before we get into it, I just want to work this out, because I see you're a Harvard Law graduate. I went to BU Law for a year. I had a professor who was farmed out from Harvard because they get to be 70 and they end up coming across the river in Boston. And I once raised my hand and he said, I'm not going to call on the Cedar because I know what he's going to say is insidious, divisive, and corrosive. And, you know, I was like,
fair.
Well, I thought it was a fair thing to say. But I could see, like, someone else may have felt, you know, intimidated by that. And that would suck. But and certainly I understand the concept of, you know, you guys are I think what we call like free speech absolutists on some level, or should be. You know, maybe not quite. Maybe that's unfair, but you should be close to that, right? Because this is the principle that you guys are watchdogging. Where, like, how much of like, but with that said, though, with free speech as a concept in this country, it's different in other countries, right? I mean, because other places don't have a First Amendment. We were talking the other day about, you know, Brazil or Germany, where there's a certain balancing act that goes on in terms of like, you know, speech and whatnot. But in terms of like the concept of free speech, how do you differentiate between a chilling effect because of social peer pressure, which is obviously it's different if if a student says this to me versus the teacher, it's different. It still seems to me to be within a realm of like social pressure on some level, although it's a little bit different again with the teacher. But where, like, from as a legal matter, where is there a concept of free speech that doesn't involve the state imposing these type of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. Not really. I mean, under the First Amendment, the prohibition on infringements on whether it's press freedom, religious freedom, it all is directed at the state. So there's no prohibition on, you know, you turning off the microphone right now and silencing me. You're free to do that. And so
I would never.
The underpinning, I hope you know, but the underpinning, though, you know, what I thought a lot about is, well, why do we protect free speech in the first place? It's because we believe that a robust exchange and a kind of dynamism in our public discourse is beneficial. It drives forward democracy. It makes for a more creative society. It can be a catalyst for innovation. And if you think about those underlying benefits that derive from free speech, you realize that in order for those to flower, you need to do more than just keep the government out of it. You've got to foster an environment, particularly on a college campus, where there is a broad range of ideas, where people feel like they can ask the hard questions. They can challenge the conventional orthodoxy. They can push back against what's being taught and point in a different direction. And so I think that's important to free speech, but it's not actually really enshrined in the First Amendment, except insofar as the government may not interfere with it.
All right, let's go. Let's talk about what's going on in Florida, because I think it's really distressing. And I think that, like, and certainly the atmosphere that it creates is certainly not conducive to that other part of the ideal of free speech, let's say. And so let's start with HB 1557, HB 7, HB 1467. The Parental Rights in Education Act, that's the what people refer to colloquially as the Don't Say Gay Law. The Stop Woke Act, which people don't even have to refer to it colloquially. That's the name, literally the name of the act, although it's W period O period K E. And a mandate that that schools maintain an online database of every book in their collections so that essentially you can apply the Woke Act and the Don't Say Gay Law. Will you walk us through what those do explicitly and don't do explicitly, but also what they do implicitly?
Yeah, sure. Let's start with, you know, what people call the Don't Say Gay Act. You know, the actual kind of threshold is below third grade, not talking about LGBTQ identities and narratives, and then beyond that age group, you know, doing it only in sort of appropriate ways. And, you know, the argument there is, look, that some of these concepts are complex, they're sensitive. Kids may not be ready to consider the full spectrum of gender identity. Some parents may want a more conventional traditional presentation of gender for young children, boys and girls, before you get into sort of the complexities that have emerged to the foreground in the last, you know, years and decades. And so at some level, I think a lot of people are sympathetic to the idea that this should be a measured process in schools. But what this law does, and I think you've said it very well, is it creates this chilling effect where there's a sense that any, you know, if a child draws a picture of their same-sex parents, you know, is that something? And the teacher puts it up in the classroom wall and that sparks the discussion. Do they then have to shut down that conversation or be at risk of a legal violation? And that's a, just a terrible position for a classroom teacher to be put in, to have to even worry about or think about that when they're leading a class. And so, and that's the point. It is not that, that what is written down on paper may sound kind of reasonable and kind of measured, but inevitably it sparks this fear and people realize what it is that the legislature is trying to get at when they enacted this law, and that, you know, they're looking for test cases. They're looking to create scapegoats and blame teachers for not adhering to this. And so that's very much the ethos. The Stop Woke Act is kind of similar, but targeting these concepts, what many people call divisive concepts. It really centers on critical race theory is the term that gets used, but it's perspectives on race that can cause people to feel blamed or a sense of accountability for past wrongs, that they're being singled out or stigmatized because of their privilege, that their a sense of guilt is being fostered, and that these kinds of programs and teachings in school are prohibited. And this, of course, raises so many questions. This is really what is at the heart of the debate over the advanced placement African-American studies issue, which has become a real flashpoint because of concerns that talking about the work of certain theorists in African-American studies may cross the line into wokeness, which is now prohibited in the state of Florida. So there again, if you're teaching American history, if you're teaching race, if you're teaching a lesson on slavery, you know, you're on notice that what you say and how you say it and even the feelings, the subjective feelings that it creates in students, you know, could jeopardize your position. And then finally, this mandate about books obviously is intended to send the message that you're being watched, that what is on the shelf is being watched and scrutinized, and don't make a false move or you're going to be in trouble.
Is there a standard that has ever been developed that seems to be deployed in the case of the Parental Rights in Education Act? Because certainly the standard that's articulated, that I think, you know, you articulated, at least in terms of like, there may be things, ideas that are too complex for third graders. I mean, having children myself and having, you know, read a book written by the former sex ed teacher from the DOE in New York City. This is the biggest public school system in the entire country. Third graders, you know, as far as I can tell, completely capable of understanding these concepts. And certainly if you're taking an AP history class, the idea that you can understand the complex, the idea that there have been past wrongs, there may be some implications to, responsibility or accountability for society, you know, today. But that's also like, that's a different standard, right, than the one that's being applied to the third graders and below. Is there a standard that exists, or is it just simply and you know, that these things are measured by? Like, what constitutes a standard? Like, when do we decide this is reasonable as opposed to like, it's just simply an ideology? Because outside, you know, it's one thing to say like, I don't want my kid to learn about this. And I mean, frankly, there's a lot of things I don't want my kid to learn about, you know, that I could pick at school, but we can't really allow that, so much because everybody would get to choose without a standard. What is the standard, or is there one?
Yeah, look, it's really difficult. There isn't a clear legal standard. You know, courts have talked about things like, you know, in a science classroom, whether information is fact-based or not, and that may be more discernible when they were having the debates over teaching the theory of evolution versus creationism. But when it comes to, you know, how to present complex questions of gender and race, I don't think there's a single standard. I also think, look, in this country, education is very decentralized. You know, we devolve that power to the states. They, for the most part, devolve it to school boards. Communities have influence. And we embrace that idea in the United States that, you know, we don't have a national school system, a single curriculum. We like the idea that, you know, there may be different moorings. I'm here in New York City. You know, these concepts are very natural and normal. My kids have grown up with them. I think they understand them. They see the complexities. And I think that's been terrific. I also recognize it's not the same way everywhere across the country. And I don't think it would work in this country to try to dictate. And so you have to have dialogue and a give and take. And we have systems for that. We have PTAs, we have parent-teacher conferences, you know, we have opportunities for people to make their voices heard. We have school board elections. The answer should not be legislation aimed to intimidate teachers and principals into submission. I know that, you know, even though figuring out a better approach where these issues are contested, a community may be divided, is not easy. I know that that is not an approach that we ought to be embracing here in the United States and under the First Amendment.
You talked about the College Board earlier, and I wanted to ask you a few questions about that, because they, from the outside, it appears that they were essentially bullied into changing their curriculum by Ron DeSantis. I mean, there is not, as you say, a standard national curriculum for a lot of students, but this is a little bit closer to that, right? I mean, the College Board has a lot of power and a lot of sway, and they seem to capitulate kind of quickly to what Ron DeSantis was pressuring them to do. How did that go down, and what's your take on the College Board's acquiescence?
Yeah, look, I mean, the College Board maintains that they came at this decision on their own, in consultation with the teachers who tried out the course and with the scholars who were involved in creating the curriculum. They're quite insistent on that. But the record shows clearly that this, you know, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, just the mere passage of the Stop Woke Act, you know, could not have and did not go unnoticed at the College Board. You know, they are aware that a big state that's a significant source of revenue has put certain ideas off limits. And what we also see is a lot of copycat bills. So that exists in the state of Florida. There are other states that have passed similar laws. They tend to be worded a little bit differently in each case, but there may be more such laws. So the College Board has to factor that in when they're thinking about, you know, who they're serving nationally and where they want this course to be adopted. So I think there can be no question that the College Board framed up this course with that as a backdrop. And, you know, perhaps it's true that they didn't experience themselves as sort of capitulating to pressure or censorship consciously, but that's how censorship works. It's insidious. You know, if you know that something could get you into trouble, you know, you have a natural tendency to stay away from it and avoid it. And, you know, in this case, it just seems that the timing of their decision, the backdrop of the communications that they had with the Florida Department of Education, the fact that certain ideas that are right in the crosshairs of the Stop Woke Act went from being part of the curriculum to being sort of ancillary and optional. I think it's pretty clear, you know, it's really hard to accept that there's a different narrative than that the outcome for this course was shaped by Florida's censoriousness. Now, you know, if you'd taken that out of the picture, maybe they would have come to the same curriculum. That's possible, but we'll never know that.
So with these laws that are being passed in Florida, what does Penn do, or what can we do, or what can broader society do to roll this back? I mean, are there going to be constitutional challenges to this? Because this is a situation, right, where while there is – do you think there are constitutional challenges that ultimately will be made to this?
Definitely there'll be challenges. I think, you know, complex and difficult questions, how they will be adjudicated, again, because we do have this very strongly rooted tradition of local control over schools, you know, and local discretion applying, whether courts and this particular Supreme Court, if it gets there, which I think it probably will decide that the state of Florida has sort of crossed a line, you know, is debatable. You know, there's not much precedent even for constitutional challenges of book bans. There's one case and the justices really were split on how far a school system can go in picking and choosing what's on the shelf. And, you know, part of that's because they comprise and curate that shelf in the first place, right? There's a librarian who's working for the school who's deciding what books to buy, what books to put out there. So there is that discretion being exercised by the state. Now, I think that's very different for somebody to assemble a collection of books versus somebody going to that collection and picking and choosing a couple of things on ideological grounds that get withdrawn from it. But the law has to be developed to make that distinction. And so I think it's going to be fascinating to see how these challenges unfold. And they're different stakeholders, faculty, students, potentially authors and theorists. So, you know, whether they have standing to bring the challenges and how the courts dispose of them is something that we're going to be watching over the next few years. In the meantime, look, there's a lot that can be done. I mean, people, Americans don't like censorship. They overwhelmingly, on a bipartisan basis, reject book banning as a tactic. We all know book banning is un-American. It's not something that we do here. And so mobilizing people, equipping people to recognize, even if you don't love everything that's happening in the classroom, that these you know, really hard-hitting pieces of legislation are dangerous infringements on our free speech rights. It's extremely important to talk about that, to mobilize people. Local voices are often the most powerful, going into the school board meetings, going in to speak to the regents and the heads of universities to say, you know, censorship is not something we want here.
On the first part, in terms of the legal challenge, the has there been a definition of what local means? Like, insofar as, like, I mean, I get the idea that we have decentralized education significantly. We have local school boards. But how, like, why do we stop in some instances at local, meaning the state, literally the state, not the state, I'm talking Florida, as opposed to certain counties, right? Because there are certain counties who undoubtedly do not want to be constrained in this way. But that's considered not local. The state's considered local. Like, state government is considered local, as opposed to, like, the federal. Like, where has there ever been any legal sort of authority on what we mean when we say local? Because it seems to float depending on where the power is.
Yeah, I think what you're really asking is how far can the state go to sort of dictate across school systems and school districts, you know, what can and can't be taught. And I think that's really an issue of state law that's going to vary from state to state. So it is a devolution of power from the state to localities to determine these things. And, you know, here in this case in Florida, you're seeing the state trying to kind of pull that back. It's not, you know, here in New York State, we've got a board of regents and they certify curriculum and you have to meet certain standards to be an accredited school. So there's, you know, there certainly is a very well established role for the state, but kind of where exactly that boundary lies and whether, you know, that whether there could be a local challenge to say, you know, we want to have, you know, on the basis of a municipality or a town, challenging the authority of the states. I honestly don't know, but I'm doubtful because I think the state probably does have that power.
Well, Suzanne Nossel, CEO of Pen America, really fascinating. Appreciate your catching us up on these things, and hopefully people get out there and agitate against this stuff as much as they can. And then maybe we'll have a sympathetic Supreme Court to this type
right.
of thing, but I find that a little bit hard to believe. At least the way it's currently constituted. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We will be taking your phone calls at 646-257-3920. We will also be taking your IMs via our IM machine, the patented IM machine that we have.
Right.
I don't know if anyone else in the world has this system.
The IM machine?
Well, I mean,
the
people have IMs.
Software we use on the Mac?
But, well, no, people have that. But do they have the Majority Report app from which you're the if you're a member that you can IM through?
An app is a machine in a sense.
This
does anybody else have that?
Sort of virtual machine.
I mean, does anybody have it?
No.
Exactly. Thank you. I rest my case. Thank you, Your Honor. Check it out. If you become a member and you get the app is free, incidentally. It's just that you get more use case stuff.
You've been watching crypto, guys?
Yeah, I know. I don't try to... you can IM the show. Also, you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And there, what you can do is jointhemajorityreport.com and allow the show to survive and thrive and bring you interviews like we brought you today.
And you can buy our merch as well if you want to support us and support, you know, my coup. You can buy the limited edition and Majority Report shirts in clay and then in powder blue. They're on shop.majorityreportradio.com.
Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Emma.
Yeah.
What's happening with the...
Tomorrow's a big day for me. What? I lost my bet to Bradley, our season-long competition against the spread, and I will be eating many different kinds of cheeses on camera, and I might throw up. YouTube.com/ESPN show.
Why? You don't like...
It's nice and warm in the studio for you to eat the cheese?
Wait,
do you want me to preemptively vomit?
You don't like cheese?
No. I feel like I've told you this, but you might have forgotten.
You don't like any type
what
of cheese?
What kind of cheeses are going to be there?
I don't know. I said, Bradley, you can get $20 worth of cheese.
Aromatics.
And aromatic just surprise me.
So
right.
The cheapest variety.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you wanted to go that route. You might have wanted him to spend more money on the cheese than
20.
See if we can get 8 varieties for 20 bucks.
That's
See,
my thinking.
I don't know.
I'm going to go for value.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to tell you. That's what's happening tomorrow. And then also, I'm sure we'll talk about sports too. But on our last episode, it was a really good one. We did a Super Bowl breakdown. Also, spoke about Pat Tillman, the continued exploitation of his memory and lies about what happened to him, as well as who's really behind those weird Jesus Super Bowl ads as well. YouTube.com/ESPN show.
I'm super concerned about this cheese thing. I got
to
tell you.
Bradley's going to have to cut away after like a minute.
I mean,
you do that at the end of the
why
show.
Why are you concerned? Now I'm really
concerned.
I'm afraid what's going to happen in the studio. I'm afraid you're not even going to show up on Friday. Like, you're going to be so cramped up.
I mean, I'm going to eat as much as I can. I'm not going to push myself as like a fear factor thing. We'll see. I mean,
I don't think it's a quantity thing. I think it's just like the different scents and stuff are going to be too much.
All right. Well, open the window. it's just...
I don't want to like, I got to check and see if like our insurance will cover this. I'm a little concerned about what's going to be going on with this. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning? Maybe you do that cheese thing outside of the...
They might do it outside on the pavement.
Yeah, maybe like...
What do you guys think is going to happen here?
I don't know. That's what I'm concerned about. All right, Matt. What's Matt Leck Media?
Episode 105 of Left Reckoning last night, neoliberal train derailment, Who Won Vietnam, Cup Lies in Austin, featuring Robert Bozenko and Seneca and Sam from Austin DSA. And in the post game, we got deep into some Elon Musk stuff. And check that out. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get access to that.
We are back in a moment. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun app.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
back. Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. 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 Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back. 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 Back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back. Back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on, fuck them, fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy. Total, pussy, 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 total, pussy.